very much.
Speaking of money, and we'll always ask you one question, then we'll have a break. Did people in the lab suffer financially during the Depression?
Well, we had our salaries cut. We had a 10% cut in salaries. I don't think anybody suffered. It would be a mental trauma, that's all. And if you say, you're going to take away so many chocolate bars or something like that from a man, then it's suffering of some kind. But it's not really suffering. But there was. I mean, there was lack of money. Oh, I remember that lack of money thing. There was the floods in China. And Fitzgerald was a member of the League of Nations health section. And they were going to send out a team out to China. Something we've been talking about. Is the thing going now?
Yes.
Well, what I was saying was that there was a Fitzgerald was a member of the health section of the old League of Nations, and there was a proposal that following a big flood in China, some team be sent out to study the possible things, the things that might happen following the flood, diseases, cholera, plague, typhus. And he was talking about this. He talked about this. Bring it up at lunchtime. And I said to my wife, I said, no, I think he wants someone to go on with. This is during the Depression. Well, I had a small family. I know money was not a thing. I mean, you can see that. So anyway, we decided at home, it might be for the future, one's future, it's a good thing to do it. I went to him, he was delighted. And the very thing he wanted. So he phoned Audubon and told him. Well, I think the country from which the man went, I think the country had to support him. I think it was something like $5,000. They wouldn't put up a club nickel. It never happened.
You must have felt disappointed having decided that you would go.
Well, I just took it well. It was all right. I knew some people in China. I also knew a man who was director of a Japanese institute in Manchuria. I was going to go there first and see him because he would know a lot about various things that were happening, and I even had a scheme for immunization against typhus. Well, it would never have come about, but it was the thing that is available now. But there was a chance to look into things. It would have been a great experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you see President Cody very often?
Not very often, no, I didn't see him very often. I think there were two or three occasions. He called me in once and asked me what I thought, who should be the next director. I didn't think it was a serious question, but, I thought it was just democracy in the sense of the decisions already made, but we just go through the form. I don't know, maybe that's wrong. And he was classically one of the men at St. Michael's. One of the men was a University College man. And I remember speaking to him. Well, he knew right away, first name went through. I didn't know him.
Did you know Walter Thompson?
No, I didn't know. I didn't know. I don't think I felt that I ever spoke to him. By the way, Professor Ramsey Wright, I was told, left Toronto rather in a pout because he wasn't made president, but that may be unjust too. He was a very capable man. I mean, capable man in the sense of talk and so on. He was acting president, I think, at a meeting I once visiting Englishmen who lectured him.
Another person that interests me in reading about the early days of the lab was Colonel Goodrum.
Yes, well, now there you see it comes back to what you remember, Miss. I remember this man who was responsible for the development of diphtheria toxoid, for the prevention of diphtheria and tetanus toxoid, prevention of the lockjaw, Rameau, Gaston Rameau. I knew him, he was a friend of mine, really. Well, he was a guest. He came over, and there was a dinner at Colonel Goodrum's house. And it's odd what you remember about a thing. After the dinner, he said, "Gentlemen, would you like some 1886 or some 1874 whiskey?" Remember, I said 74. Because I thought, well, I'll never get a chance. I've been many years to get that again.
No.
But I don't remember. It was just, he was I've seen him lots of times. You know?
It interests me to know why he was so interested in the lab.
Well, I tell you what it was in part. I wonder at that time, you see, he'd been engaged in the distillery business. And I don't think he was actually engaged in anything at this time. I'm not too sure about that. But he was a man who was, I suppose, in a sense, how active he was as a colonel. But I think he had kind of a sense of loyalty. This was a needed thing, this business of tetanus antitoxin. And he had the money. And it may have been just without too much thought about anything at the beginning that he decided to support this, to buy this place for it. Well, then he continued his interest, and probably the interest grew. I think it was something that was... certainly wasn't full blown at the beginning, I'm sure of that.
He must have been a very useful man of sport for Professor Fitzgerald at the beginning of the lab.
Oh, yes. Oh, months boys. But he was a fine man. He was a fine man. I didn't know, as I said, I didn't know him. He was really a very fine man, I'm sure.
Is this business of people being credited for research such as you were talking about with McLeod, is that a real problem?
I don't know. I don't know. Now, some places are, you hear this kind of thing, that somebody does something, and somebody else. I think it's a horrible, now this, because this often happens, but certainly research is shared. I think that almost, if you're into anything at all much, it almost has to be. And I don't think there's any difficulty there at all, you know, thing is shared. But there's someone who's sitting as a kind of image at the top who would take credit for something that was done and he knew, didn't even know anything about it. This, I don't know how often that happens.
Did it happen to you?
I don't think so. I don't think so. This kind of thing comes in a little bit, you know. It may have been a thing, but it's something I wouldn't want to even let enter the threshold of my consciousness, you know, because it turned out that people are good people anyway, and so what difference does it make, you know? But I think there could be cases like that that could come about easily. One can think of that, but I wouldn't want to even think of a thing like that. I think things can come. Not like the accidental things too that happen to people. I don't know. But this kind of point. You know, here's something that came up. I had to give a couple of interviews in French on a French station here. Now, that's the toughest thing when talking to you, you know, because why do I speak French? I'm not. This isn't my language, you know. And is everything in French? The whole business. Well, and then. You're supposed to be the general subject, you're supposed to be such and such. And there was a new lab opened up there, and they hear about this because these notices come through the university, and then the French station, they want to get in on the thing too, you see. And I had a couple of times this happened. And then what if he did would ask me, do you think there's too much money spent on medical research? No. Well, this is a long question. There's got to be waste in any case. There's great waste in research. There always is. There has to be. I mean, things are done. It may not be eventual waste. But I tell you what, the waste comes in this way. But certainly all of the results, all the observations made, all the things done, don't come to publication. And if you want to call that waste, you know, and even the things that come sometimes aren't so significant, you know. And, so I don't know, but I found that. I think I said, in reality, no. What can you do? I didn't want to get my head chopped off after I left the, place.
No. Did you ever have any interest in going to work somewhere else, like outside Toronto or outside Canada?
Well, I've spent a bit of time, not permanently, you know. I've spent, some time in the laboratory, physiological laboratory in Belgium, and another time in Germany. But that was only for months. You mean give up the thing? Well, I didn't. I had a chance. I had an offer of the job. But the Squibb Company came and asked for me. Squibb Company. And I thought, but I said, no, I'm awful glad I did. The best thing that I'm able to work now is immensely better. And you can't. I don't know what could happen. Unless, of course, if one were crimped in what they were doing and they weren't allowed this and they had a great lack of freedom, he'd want to get out of it anyway.
But you never had that.
Oh, I never had that at all. Not at all. It's been a most extraordinary thing, I think. And I know people, some people have thought it's a waste of time, you know. They might say, isn't that old so-and-so dead yet, you know? But, I mean, the point is, I won't tell you the words there, but they had, people could say that, what, and they might be irritated and say, but from my point of view, it's just been wonderful.
So if you go back, I'd like to ask you a bit about Dr. Dupreez.
Dr. Dupreez.
When did you first get to know him?
1919. Didn't know him well, but I know him since then. I've known him on and off. And I tell you one thing about Dr. Dupreez. I think from some point of view, he was an awfully good director. In this sense, now I'm not talking about direction in the sense of telling what research has to be done, but in the sense of the overall running of the place. Now, he was a man very keen about the two things kept together, hygiene and the conflict. I'm rather indifferent about this. I was always... My work is what I wanted. I wasn't interested in any kind of university politics or something. But he was this, and not only that, he saw that the funds weren't dropping down. He was a good economist, and he kept things in a very nice shape. And many good problems. I remember once he came to me, and there was a man named Bickle, a mining man, a very wealthy man. And he came to me, you know, this between Christmas and New Year's, when people want to get advantage of something by giving money and something like that. And a man, of course, if you're in some categories, I suppose you could give $100 and it only mean 20 for them. I'm not sure, but I mean, you know, this sort of thing. But anyway, whatever the thing was, Dr. Fitzgerald came up and said, Mr. Bickle wants to give money to the lab. Well, you know, at that time of year, you have all your research projects pretty well planned and underway. So I said to him, well, I'd like to think about this. But I thought it was something I thought, well, it's rather interesting. It's rather interesting thing anyway. It was a very simple idea. And it was this thing of, you know, cholesterol in the arteries, you know. And this can be, you can bring this state about in rabbits extraordinarily easy. You give a very large dose of cholesterol, the deposits in the arteries are very quickly, you get deposits very quickly in the arteries of the animal. And you open an animal up, and especially the one that just leaves the heart, the aorta, and you find it sometimes after continuous, almost occluded, almost blocked. Well, it's very easy to do it with a rabbit because they're fed, pellets, hard pellets. And you can dissolve great quantities of cholesterol in, say, peanut oil, and let the thing soak into these pellets, and then drain them. And if they're going to eat, they have to ingest cholesterol, that's all. So we, this is a duck we eat tailor. Let's see, about 20 rabbits. And after a certain time, we examined a few and we found out that this state had been brought about, this deposit of cholesterol, it was very obvious. And then the interest I had as far as the lab was a thing called heparin. If one takes a meal high in fat, and blood is drawn shortly afterwards, and allowed to clot, it looks milky, there's a fatty substance. If you get an injection of cholesterol, of heparin, and draw the blood, then it's clear, it's absolutely clear. Anyway, whatever the explanation is, it doesn't matter now. But I thought, well, let's see what happens here. We divided the things into two parts, and put them on a normal diet. One group every day got heparin, every day. And then at the end of 3 months, they sacrificed all the animals. And one of the 10 on heparin had absolutely normal arteries. There was nothing wrong with them. Fortunately, one of the others also had the same thing. It had nothing to do with heparin at all. And it remains a mystery to me still. I didn't go on with it. But the point as far as I was concerned was that this big one remained for a long time with me, and I was able to get started on a new project on insulin altogether. So this is really very interesting.
When did that money come?
I must have been around 52 or something like that. And then about 54 or 53, or I don't know, when I began this new stuff on insulin. It turned out to be a very fruitful thing.
What went on in the lab during the war, aside from vastly increased production? Is there any war research being carried on?
Well, I think you'd have to say, now there's another thing that I don't want to speak really. I don't feel that I have any great cause, because one forgets, But I think there must have been research, because on a thing like typhus vaccine, I think the method of making wasn't devised, but there's always, well, for example, Darlene Taylor, on the production of a medium suitable for the production of the tetanus toxin used in turn to make toxoid, that was more research.
Was any of it secret?
I don't think it was. I'm just trying to think if I can imagine any secret things. I don't think so. One of the jobs was in connection with the gas ganglion serum, which I think is useless stuff anyway, but it was made in great quantities. There were three different types, and it had to be very clear so you had the right type and the right kind of toxin, the right kind of antigen, and so on. I forget how many horses were one of the. They even used the racing stables of Hamilton for some of the horses. And I had a very good setup for that, and I got the thing set up in such a way that you could hardly make a mistake. There were no mistakes made, anyway. And quite a few girls working on this. Well, when you start with a secret, there came over people from Russia, two men, And we were told they wanted to find out everything about the land. And so they came about this, and they once spoke English. They both did, I think certainly one did. And they wanted to know what we did. Well, I was told we were supposed to tell them, but I thought, well, I asked them, are you concerned with this problem in Russia? Do you make it? Oh yes, we do this in Russia. So I told them in great detail, and they wrote down this and that and so on and all the rest of the whole thing. And then I said, now, how do you do this in Russia? Well, there was no answer. And then I said, now, maybe you didn't understand me. So very clearly I restated the whole thing. And there was some snap, some Russian one who just walked out of the room. This is a terribly bad man, too. If I wouldn't have told them anything, that's all. If people aren't good, well-mannered, you know, you can say, even if you can deal with secret things, you can say, well, look, we can't tell you that, that's all. But you can be honest.
But there were no problems of publication or anything during the war?
No, not that I know of. No more than you. Remember, I published some things then on methods of testing, tetanus toxoid, seven English journals this month at that time.
Did you ever work out at the farm, or have you always been down here?
No, I never worked there. No, I go there every so often now, you know. And, it's rather a nice place, a little far off, but you can go by common carrier. It's pretty slow. I drive out. And, no, I never worked there. Never worked at the farm. I remember Dr. Fitzgerald, he came back, he wasn't well. He was with Mr. Orr. I went out to ask him something. And he said, why don't you come work here, Dr. Fitzgerald said to me. I was a little shortly before he died, not a few weeks before he died.
I'd like to go right back to the very beginning for a few minutes to talk a little bit more about your time at St. Michael's, because it was so interesting.
Okay.
What sort of rooms did you live in? Did you live by yourself?
At one stage, as high school boys, we lived in common dormitories, several beds in a room. And we had to... half past five was early to get up in the morning, in the winter time, I want to tell you now. And there wasn't individual showers or all the rest of us, you know. And there were facilities, but they were common facilities, you know. And you tend to forget the past. One thing they had at St. Michael's, a very good scientific lab. And I was able to go there and do some work. That's what really got me. I think, well, I was interested in this anyway, this kind of thing, but I used to, it wasn't even connected to the course, you know. I remember around 1910 or something, I assembled the materials that were available, a simple outfit that you could send a wireless signal, you know. And I could ring a bell in the next room, you know, without any wires attached. You know, I would get a tremendous thrill out of it. And I remember very well it cost me 10 cents. Because at one stage you have to have a mixture of nickel and silver filings. Well, the nickel I got from an American nickel, which I destroyed, and a Canadian 5-cent piece, which I destroyed. You know, going back to that time, I remember there was somebody had a French book on physics. Tape recording was done in France, certainly in the first decade of this century. It was a very crude sort of thing. What really made it something is electronics. The signals were so faint. This thing came about 16. One of the old men, a Canadian, who had done his novitiate in France, the place they had a place, still have a place called Annonay, not so far from Lyon. And Annonay always reminds me of the Montgolfier brothers. They were the ones that went up and made a balloon, you know, the first balloons in Montgolfier. And I saw a Montgolfier balloon not long ago over here, on the front of it. He put up like boys going up in a Montgolfier balloon. And, this old man, he taught us French. He was a marvelous man, a classical scholar. Oh, culture, the man taught. He would speak in English, it was just reading from a book, you know. And he was a Canadian, but French, teaching us French. Well, French, we had a book called, French book called Leçon des Choses. Well, of course, we were there. I remember it was high school. It's 1 year I had in high school there. And we'd try to turn him off the French and ask him something, and he would talk so well and tell us about, it might be something that came in this little part on Leçon des Choses, you know. And he told us interesting stuff. He told us one time about the chemical laboratory they had at Annonay. And they had no gas or electricity. They had to have charcoal with bellows, you know. And the boys wear leather aprons, and a whole day was spent in the lab. The man in charge of the instructor was a man from the Polytechnique in Paris, a well-trained man at that time. And they did things there that no laboratory does now. For example, they would make elementary phosphorus from bones got from the kitchen. I mean, the phosphorus you put on your finger, take fire from the heat of the finger. Years afterwards, he died in the 30s. By that time, I had a little bit of sense. And I spoke to him. I said, when was that? Before the war. That's before the war of 1870. Trying to question the war.
What was the man's name?
Mick Brady.
One thing I wanted to ask you when we were talking about your early days in the Kant lab was how you got your PhD.
You mean how?
Since you said you were doing it while you were working.
Yes, I could do that. You know, I was registered, you see, for this. And I came on and we just carried on. I had a rather good piece of work.
Who was your supervisor?
Well, the people in the chemistry department, you see, and they were there in full attendance at the final examination. And Miller and Allen came up.
Well, were you still working for Professor Kendrick?
No. This is not this is
earlier.
But I kept this up, you see. I remember about Professor Kendrick and the Connaught too. When I came there, it happened that I was be the first one in Toronto, I think, to do pH measurements by electrometric method, you know, and I had to devise, I had to assemble my own potentiometer and make my own electrodes and all the rest of it. Well, I devised a small electrode which was very rapid in its action. And I remember I went to Professor Kennedy, he's a good glass blower. I want to get something done, you know. I could do it myself afterwards, but They were much taken with, Miller was much taken with this. I published the thing. And he was much taken with this method. So I had good support. That was before the PhD thing altogether. And they knew what I was doing and so on like that. They may have made it easy for me, I'm not sure.
Who approved your thesis topic for your PhD?
I suppose the people in chemistry.
It wasn't one individual, it was done by a group?
Well, it could be, I suppose, Miller would be the man.
Did you see him very often while you were working on it?
No, I didn't. I've seen him once in a while. No, I didn't. This is one of Kendrick's ideas, I think. But you mustn't guide a man too much. You know? I think it's right too. You know, Kendrick was a man who was frightened of explanations. It always seemed to me that he was a tremendous man. I happened to be, in passing, the only man at the University at his funeral. The one person from the University of Kansas?
No, what happened was, there was a dinner down at the University Club, and someone said, Kendrick's dead. He's going to be buried tomorrow. And what should I think for Tom? I'm going to go back. This in Montreal. So I rushed home, told him I'm going to Montreal. I was down in Montreal that night. And I was very glad because at the gravesite, I could, I spoke to Mrs. Kendrick. It was Mrs. Kendrick, the daughter who was married, Mrs. Wells. I'd never met them before. I'd never met any of them before. And the grandson. And I told Mrs. Kendrick what I thought about him. She said, will you tell my grandson just what you said to me now? I said, for that moment, I was very glad I went down. But they had, coming back again to this business of Kendrick, I think that's why they left me alone. This is a policy, you know. What have they got? What are your results? Let's see the results. That's all we're interested in. And the results were all right. They were interesting. Miller was interested in it very much, but I reported that at a meeting in Cincinnati. See, there was this kind of contact. He was at a meeting in contact, American Chemicals, at a meeting in Cincinnati. And he was at the meeting there when I gave the paper. And he had to get up and make some remarks to me. So I had the thing almost in the bag before it was almost formally brought up, you know.
How long did it take you to finish it?
A couple of years. I'm not sure the length of time. But I'm coming back to this thing about explanation. And see, Kendrick was criticized because they didn't talk about molecules and atoms. They talked about reality all the time. And the interpretation of things as they are. They weren't against these other things, but they were always afraid of someone being driven into some position which would have doors closed. The mind would be closed. I mean, even such a venerable thing as evolution, it can be a dangerous thing. I'm not talking about nothing about religion, I don't mean that that's taught. But for example, you're doing some work in your life. I know it myself. I follow this policy rigidly. You want to get an animal closest to man. What is the animal? Well, you can't answer this. You have to ask a question. In what way? Well, because of influence. Well, a pig. Pig influence very close to you, and also to one type of whale, or something like that. Look for something suitable for a study of influenza. Well, a parrot is a suitable animal. You know? I'm not against using monkeys or apes. I mean, I don't mean that at all. But I think that minds can be turned wrongly by assuming that we know the final answer. Well, Kendrick is a man more, I think thanks to him I have this attitude, you know, to Kendrick. And it was, people criticized him. They said, well, look, they split the atom. I don't think he's a problem. I don't, for example, they never preached anti-molecule or that sort of thing over there. But they'd always ask you, how do you know? And this is the thing that came up. And there was always a great lesson in logic, I think, with them. This is Kendrick's attitude toward things. So if you're really talking clearly about something, it's a very difficult thing. It's a very difficult thing in the science and chemistry to really talk clearly. And this is all he wants. This is the course.
Wonderful training.
Whoa, he's a marvelous man. He's just a marvelous man, Kendrick. And then you have a great affection for him. It's not at all. I mean, even though Miller was a very brilliant man, and the devotee of Willard Gibbs, the mathematician physicist at Harvard in the last century, who, by the way, I think was discovered by the Germans, you know. But Miller was a great devotee of him in thermodynamics. But even so, I think Kendrick is the greatest man in the chemistry department myself. And a man of tremendous character. In fact, in a narrow sense of the word, he was scrupulous. For example, in money matters. He never was honest, you know. But somebody working there, I wasn't the one demonstrating, you get so much you want. Well, then there was a knock to
supervised examination. $8 for the day. You can't take it. You have to deduct it from your I mean, this was just, it wasn't meanness, it was just a kind of utter honesty. I know I had a little small apartment, a little budget, not enough money to buy a certain piece of apparatus. So I thought, all right, we've got this much, and of course if you turn it in, down you went. So I went to one of them, I knew one of them smiled, and I said, I want to buy that, I haven't got enough money, suppose I... Would you give me credit for this now? Oh, fine. And I got the other end and bought it. Okay, it was horrible. This was. But, I mean, it was a kind of character. I think the man was just transparently honest, that's all. Right? And this kind of thing I put down as a kind of abnormal scrupulosity, this kind of thing, you know. But he was a man that he could. Now, in the lecture, I mean, lots of people thought that he was a poor lecturer. I mean, I don't know how much is in it. But he was a very clear-headed man. So when he was going to explain something, he just made it crystal clear. Because he was used to, he'd been schooled in this thing of, what do you mean when you're talking about something? Oh, you put a thing down, that's crystal clear. But he wouldn't do that in a lecture.
Jonathan,
are there any questions or areas that are particularly interested to you that I haven't asked you about? Are there any people that you were particularly impressed with and I asked you questions about? I don't think so. I don't think it's so much interest the people of later life, you know, that have been with me, as associates. Good people. The odd thing is that my experience in life has been this, madam. Everybody that I've worked with has turned out to be a good person. I mean, it's an odd thing. And I can't look back and say, well, here was somebody or something I don't know. Well, there's something I need to talk about. And I think, I'm not so sure that's maybe that's the case everything. That's my experience.
I think it depends on your attitude.
I suppose it does. I don't know. But I can't think. Some marvelously talented people who have been associated with me in the room. And I mean, they've had limitations, as I have limitations. I mean, no, that's not
what it is. What research are you doing now?
Well, it's still on the question of immunology, and this came out of a study of the antigenicity of insulin. You know, people thought for a long time that insulin wasn't antigenic, because it wouldn't produce antibodies. You wouldn't develop resistance thanks to injection of insulin. And there was a good reason for that, because here you had thousands and thousands of people every day receiving injections, and on the whole, no difficulty. Sometimes it'd be difficult, but people thought they were so rare, it must be some other cause. Well, at any rate, I had a student, man won't do so much, I said, well, I'll do this. Do it this way. It was very fortunate what I said, because it just happened, I mean, more or less accidental. A man, a friend of mine, Jules Freund, he had a certain thing called an adjuvant. It's mixed with an antigen that enhances the antigenic value. And then I want to make a certain kind of test for antibody or for immunity response, and the guinea pig was the suitable animal for that. Oh, right away, the results came right away that it was antigenic, and that guinea pig had developed in a very high degree antibodies to this thing, so that at the beginning, so much would affect the guinea pig, to lower the blood sugar. After a while, it took tremendous amounts to lower the blood sugar, you know? Not only that, you took the serum from these guinea pigs, take the blood and get the serum. This serum, if mixed with insulin, would neutralize it. And if you injected this into a mouse, for example, neutralized the insulin whole mouse, and the mouse became diabetic at once. And this was really a very thrilling thing for me.
That's been worrying, though.
Wait, what?
must be been worrying if a lot of people were taking insulin.
Yeah, but they weren't getting reactions.
They weren't.
But once in a while, no, it doesn't happen. Because it happens, there's another reason for that I found out later on why it's so. What it does, some people do. And at this time, or shortly afterwards, then they found out that guinea pig insulin, with the antibodies you get, you couldn't neutralize it, you know. But if you immunized a horse, the serum would neutralize the insulin of a rabbit and the guinea and the mouse and the sheep and a whale and human and monkeys and horse, but not guinea pig. Guinea pig stood by itself. And in fact, in the phylogenetic scale of mammals, you know, this is another thing about this business about evolution. You see, there's a tremendous, there's a great similarity between insects, from the mouse to the whale, including humans. But those mammals, guinea pigs, like them, they're just in a different order. As a matter of fact, in respect of insulin, we're more closely related to some fish than we are to guinea pigs, you know? I mean, this is the interesting thing. There was a woman came up, Dr. Ezra had a case in the General Hospital. She developed just marked resistance. So her serum would neutralize this and this and this and this in very marked degree. Well, poor woman, she had one leg off and the other foot going bad thanks to the diabetic, and diabetic couldn't be treated with insulin. And, it felt bad. So, anyway, I went on looking. Well, we found codfish insulin is not as easily neutralized as pig or beef insulin or ox insulin. But it would be no good because you develop antibodies to that. But we went on making chemical studies at the same time altering, you see. And one of the alterations was putting in sulfate groups. But that's an interesting thing, and that turned out to be useful. It wouldn't develop antibodies easily at all, it would be effective in the face of high antibodies. Well, on the first case, a man in Vancouver, the doctor phoned me, and we had some available. And this man wasn't treated by 1,500 units a day. And the doctor said to me, he's got lymphocytic leukemia. Well, I thought, well, it's a terminal case anyway. So so I sent the stuff out, and very quickly got him under control. And then the leukemia was better. Now, I think that was an accidental thing. But he went on, and he was finally on small doses of this insulin. He's a bar back at his job. And I was out last year, so I thought, well, he died at 9 years later from. He died of leukemia in the end. But Israel, and then other cases, like some other cases, like another case in St. Mary's Hospital in London, someone won 4,000 units a day and something like this. Well, it's a small, there's small usefulness, but apparently it's there. Well, then I became interested in this problem. Could you render an animal such that he couldn't develop antibodies, or were able to do that with a guinea pig? Against insulin. He's normal in every other way, because you have to be normal, because otherwise you'll fall prey to disease. You can do that by giving chemicals, you know? Certain chemicals, they do in transplant cases. But this one, the guinea pig, they lay down like that. So this is interesting, you know? And this is the kind of aspect of this problem I've got on that. By making a certain chemical alteration in the molecule, and giving that to an insulin, to a guinea pig, then he doesn't, he's very resistant, he might develop a spurs. If you didn't do that, he'd be like that. Well, this way, because he can't get any better than that, you know. He's very, very well. I mean, this is the sort of thing. And that's been interesting.
And you're still working on
it? Oh, yes. I mean, with that kind of thing, there's no end to it, madam. I mean, it's just, this kind of research, you know, all it does is expand the horizon of ignorance, you know. You do something, and there's more questions come up, you know. But I'm fortunate because I'm an old man, and you're still able to go on, you know.
And
I'm
still enjoying it. You're obviously still enjoying it.
Well, yes, it's all, it's his all, it's fine. And I don't know how I get support from MRC at all, and they'll keep it up.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rollins.
Thank you, madam. Well, let's see if some.